Welcome to the Association of American Law Schools 2003 Annual Convention. Recorded live, January 2 through 5, 2003 in Washington, D.C. The material recorded on this cassette is the sole property of the presenters and the AALS. All rights are reserved. Any unauthorized duplication, copying, transcription, or other use of this material without the express permission of both the presenters and the association is strictly prohibited. This program has been recorded and produced by RRC Audiovisual. This is tape number 19, a continuation of the section on legal writing, reasoning, and research entitled Better Writing, Better Thinking.
I have not done this technique, but I can see that it's one of many things that are nice to have in your quiver of ammunition to sort of show them what's going on. How am I reacting as a reader? The third one is one that I think many of us do. This is why we're all fans of the overhead, and I, in fact, carry around my little pens, is the overhead critique, where we put one paper up on the overhead, talk about it. I always talk about it, and I tell my students, I'm either going to show something that is good or that is a classic mistake. I don't put the unique mistakes up on the overhead. Those I call my husband, listen to this. But that is sort of our equivalent of the stand-up Socratic dialogue. Because while we're correcting papers, that's all individually, student to student to student. What we're doing with the ones we put on the overhead, that's a vicarious dialogue that we have, where we're showing everybody, here's what could be right or wrong. The last thing, and I tried to think of a label for this, is called consciousness raising. Just to get them to get the point that there's somebody out there going to read this, this paper, and it's not your mother, okay? And one way I do this is by pictures, and some of you may have seen these pictures, where I have, here's the fantasy reader. She's taking good notes, she's really careful about it. This is not a typical reader. Judges have full desks. I'm sparing you my full shtick. The judge is not always the first reader, often it's the clerk, okay, who is busy and has stuff going on. And that not all clerks are devoted to their work. And that, you know, they're, okay, I gotta read this thing, what's going on? And that finally, I don't want to diss judges, but I know many of them read while they're in their robes, okay? What is fascinating when I show these pictures is when practitioners and grown-ups laugh a lot. That's my dad, by the way. I don't, you know, I didn't go into a judge's bedroom and take his picture. But they don't laugh at this because they're still back on the first one. My God, isn't that who's reading my work? You know, I had a student say to me once about the adjunct, you know, if she really worked on it, she could figure out what I was trying to say. And I think to know that was such a gift to me, because that's the problem. They are thinking that Superman is coming to read their paper and that, oh, I don't understand this. Well, let me go do some research on it so that I can understand it better. No, folks, this is it. Whatever's here is what they get. Whatever's not here, they ain't going to get. And the product method made you think that the communication of the language is so perfect that all we have to do is go, and we're going to get and understand the message. There's no independent thought going on. It's just all here right on the surface. So one of the other things I want to make them think about is that readers are not just these static absorbers of information. I tell the story, and actually bring up my dad again, of the captain's log, not on Stardate, but the captain wrote in the log that the first mate was drunk that day, which was true, but he'd never been drunk before. Come on, everyone else was drunk. Why'd you punish me? So when he was keeping the log, when the captain was off duty, he wrote, the captain was sober today. Okay? Now, you're all laughing because you did the math. Oh, it must be significant to note that the captain was sober. And what I'm trying to tell my students, your reader is going to be thinking. They're going to be jumping to conclusions. They're going to be taking what you wrote and thinking, what does that mean? Why did they write that? And so just trying to make them realize, not only are you trying to communicate, but the reader is not a passive participant in this communication. Linda Edwards talks about the commentator, okay, that, you know, that little voice in your head where you go, huh, what, oh my God, what, huh, as you're reading, and trying to make people listen to that commentator and hear that commentator as they're writing, anticipate that commentator, so that we've got this incredibly complex communication going on where we've got sort of the thinking and the meta-thinking going on as the people are communicating. And finally, hello. Da-da-da. Oh, I've got it over there. Okay. The final thing I'm going to talk about, and since I'm really trying to zoom here, is peer critiques. I talked about the stories already, the peer critiques, where we get them to read, be a reader themselves, experience that themselves. Sue Lemer, some of you may remember, put out a plea on the listserv because she was creating a document for peer critiques One, I just want to point out this. All good legal writing considers the point of view of the audience, the reader. One way to learn to put yourself in the position of the reader is to experience it yourself. So giving them that experience and having them, have that feeling and that understanding. Okay, now I want to shift quickly to how do we guide that point of view. And one of the ways we do it is by giving that scaffolding, giving those articulated criterias and formulas that we give, the criteria sheets. And I know a lot of us have questions on our criteria sheets. Did the writer divide the document into organized segments based on the issues and rules that the case presented? Did the writer cite appropriate authority for each issue addressed? You know, did the writer do this and that and the other thing? So making them think, guiding them, giving them that scaffolding, trying to create a routine for them. And with many of us, we might want to think about, well, gee, for the first draft, I might have a different set of questions than I would have for the final draft. Because at the first draft, their thinking is going to be at a different stage, at a broader stage than at a later draft. So I might try to articulate questions that are the kind of questions you would be asking at the beginning rather than the kind of questions you would be asking at the end. And then related to that also is the concept of Socratic commenting, of where we ask when we're commenting, we don't say, don't do it this way, do it that way. And this is really based on what is happening in the stand-up classroom. In the classical Socratic classroom, if a person gives a wrong answer, the professor is not going to say, no, wrong. You should not have said A, you should have said Q. Okay, now my next question is, no. When someone says A, they say, well, now why did you say A? Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And so when we're critiquing, we're going to try to imitate that and not just say, you wrote this wrong, here's what it should be, but why did you write this? Did you consider this? Did you consider that? To try to get them to think and discover on their own. Okay, now, Judith's, I had the benefit of reading Judith's writing before her chapters that she's working on in her text, and one of the things she said was, what wonderful work people in legal writing are doing with our scholarship and what's going on. And what Joanne asked in her remarks is, why aren't we spreading this more to the rest of the academy? So I talk about spreading the good news. And one question I have is, why have we been pioneers in visible thinking? The first reason is, you know, necessity, the mother of invention. I taught 72 students when I was at one school. Yeah, I still shudder at the memory. And some of you, how many of you teach more than 50 students a semester, critique paper tomorrow? God bless you. And if you're not religious, somebody bless you. Because that is a lot of work. That is a lot of critiquing. And so we're trying to think, how can I do something that's going to make this more effective, make this more efficient? The second thing we've had, and sometimes we may have felt it was a burden, but it really became a benefit, is the blank slate. Nobody else had done it before at our school, maybe, or the person who had was there for only 2 years and then left. We were on our own, and we had to figure it out. We had to struggle. We had to come up with something. And although, as I say, it felt at times like a burden, I think in some ways it became a blessing for us because we had to work from that. The third reason is, I think, that our goal kind of was an outcome-based goal. What is your goal as a teacher of legal writing? We have to teach them how to write. That and related to that is the way that we teach the class. We sort of did, and I'm going to move on to saying how professional organizations help, but we also got into the professional composition theory, because the whole writing process thing came from there, and we just said, oh, thanks very much, let's steal this, okay. And that we had done it always in school, that you, for when you took writing classes in school, you never just gave them something at the end of the semester, you did it all the way through, and you worked on it all the way through. And so instead of doing the typical exam method where we didn't just lecture about legal writing all semester and then say, okay, please write a paper and turn it in 3 hours, go. That we did it from the process from the beginning because we wanted to see, oh, are they getting it? Oh my gosh, they're not. Now I've got to do something to make them get it. Whereas I think the typical thing in the exam course is, in many of them, and not speaking for all of them, I don't know all of them, they read the exam, oh my gosh, some of them got it, some of them didn't. Next time I'll do it differently perhaps. But for these students, the party's over. Whereas we kind of like, I've got to help Billy get to a better product and be a better writer by the end of the semester. Now, why are we not having other faculty in the doctrinal faculty, stand-up faculty, whatever word you want to use, the faculty, as I believe Kent would call it, do these? One of them is inertia. They didn't have the blank slate. They came in to teach. Here's how I was taught. Many of us never had a formal legal writing course, but we had to teach it. Oh, I guess I better think of something. But if you come in and, gee, I took torts in law school, and I know how that was taught. I know how the person who taught it last year taught it. And so, boy, you know, it's the tendency of a property emotion to remain emotion, the tendency of a property teacher who's always given exams to continue to give exams. The second reason, Jane Austen, okay. My husband said, I said, what's her most famous novel? He said, Jane Eyre. No. Pride and Prejudice. How many of us have experienced Pride and Prejudice with non-legal writing faculty? You know, I've been dissed by drunk professors, as I told you earlier. And that I think, I say that legal writing is the closest thing in the academy to manual labor. So it must not be intellectual, you know. And so I think that there's this fear sometimes of pedagogy that comes from legal writing that it must be lesser somehow. Time pressures, if we're talking about 90 students in a classroom, oh my gosh, how can I include writing in that situation when I've got 90 students? And I think related to that is the prejudice that writing always means critiquing all the papers and giving them all back. When, as we know, there's lots of different things we can do. There are writings that they turn in that I don't critique. The self-graded draft, I don't critique. I just talk to them about it. And so one of the things that we have had to deal with in our desperation, maybe we can really do something good and transfer some of that. The other is the process-based goal, where they're not seeing the paper till the end of the semester. Their goal is, I have to teach them, I have to do all this conversation all throughout the semester, and then we're going to see who got it and who didn't by means of these grades, and they have the pressure of the curve that they've got to do. When I've talked to people about, well, gee, have you ever thought of, you know, in many classes, students have no idea what the exam is going to be until they see it. You know, some people have practice exams, some people don't. Some people have a little review session at the end of the semester. Sometimes they go in the exam saying, I wonder what it's going to look like. You know, well, I guess it'll be rectangular, you know, but other than that, they have no idea what it's going to be. And I sometimes will chat with profs about, well, what do you, you know, have you thought about sort of teaching, not teaching here's my exam and how it's going to be, but what is the goal of an exam? Because I guess the question I have is, if a good exam is evidence of good legal reasoning, which I would think is true, and I have not tested that philosophy, could we teach people to write better legal exams, and by teaching them how to write better legal exams, teach them to be better legal thinkers? And one answer to that is, well, but isn't that going to wreck my curve? Okay? Which relates to another question of fear of telling too much. And I say, I know that I have these criteria sheets, and I show them to a dean at one of the many schools I've taught at, and he said, well, doesn't that just give it all away? And, you know, don't they all write the same paper when you give them these criteria sheets? Yes, in my dreams, I wish that I could get them all to do that. And it is this fear of, well, I know, because I think one of the real goals and one of the real good things about legal education is the sort of concept of self-teaching and figuring it out and learning to apply. And this fear of, if we tell them too much, we're interfering with that somehow. And so I think what we've got to do is figure out, how can we articulate that here is what is not too much. Here's what is not giving them too much to do. And finally, lack of integration. You know, I link everything I talk about in legal writing to status. When you have an idea coming from someone who is a two-year faculty member, or who is a faculty member who doesn't have status, doesn't have the vote, isn't allowed to serve on committees, or is allowed to serve on committees only at the same level as students, something like that, that is not a person whose ideas are necessarily considered to be as worthy as others. The other thing is, the faculty don't know what we're doing. In my school, I'm really lucky. My faculty knows what we're doing because they're doing it. Our faculty are integrated in legal writing, and so I will not be surprised if some of our faculty start integrating writing more into their other classes because they see how it works. So as long as we're the only ones teaching these classes and they're the only ones teaching those classes, it makes it hard for those ideas to spread. It makes it hard for us to have that cross-termination. And so integration and status are very important. And I'm going to stop. Okay. Kent, and I'll let you take it away.
It's 10 after 3, and we have till 3:35 because we have to have this business meeting. And I think what I'm going to do is just tell you what questions I've been asked to provoke you to discuss. I have some just quick observations or general observations to these two presentations, and I'm going to open it up for discussion. But the questions that I've been encouraged to ask you to think about, so I want you to be prepared to speak about, come from the end of Judith Wagner's presentation, and they include what dilemmas you have encountered in using writing to enhance students' thinking, and what are the best practices beyond those, including some of those you've seen in Mary Beth Beasley's presentation, to enrich students' thinking abilities. You can also comment on the relationship between thinking and writing if you wish. I'm going to try and bounce off that quickly, but leave at least 10 to 15 minutes for discussion, if that's okay. What I'd say, I'm grateful to Joanne Duraco and also to Joan Bloom from the section for putting this together. It's kind of weird for me to speak from a dean's or an institutional perspective on those two presentations, and it's pretty much because Judith Wagner remains the role model of a great dean. She kind of walked me through my crises my first year, and as you can tell, and I think all of you know, Mary Beth Beasley is kind of the best person I know who understands managing the institutional perspective on a good writing and research program. So I feel like the Vanderbilt football coach advising Ohio State in Miami. But I'll take my job as I find it. First, some quick observations generally, and then a couple observations each presentation. First, starting with least important, some general observations. I taught legal research and writing to 42 students more than 20 years ago. When you read Judith Wagner's paper that will come out, you'll discover it talks about what seems to be now, based on visiting 15 or 16 law schools, thick and thin models of legal writing or research programs. I think my experience is with the wafer thin model. I would like to think of it as the svelte model, but I think another word for it would be the cheap model. It was in many ways the most demanding, in some ways the most tedious, and in most ways the most rewarding teaching I've done. And in the sense of, you feel like you're grading individual exams for each student every 3 weeks, going over each one line by line sometimes, with terrific variance among the students in terms of what they need from you. And you see terrific progress. You feel like you have deftly led them step by step, painful step through that process. And then they attribute it all to their contracts professor. The theory then was of what I was doing was not just invisible, it was unthinkable that there would be a theory. And so it's worth reflecting how far the profession has come in the scholarship, in the thinking, in the writing about what's being done, because it felt like there was almost none when I did this 20 years ago. The second general observation is a terrific variance in how curriculums change and how far different schools have come in changing it. Judith's study, as well as the source book on legal writing programs, suggests that there's just such a variance about curriculums and thinking and writing at law schools with these thick and these thin schools, or svelte or cheap schools, or whatever you want to call them, even among comparable schools on other levels. I mean, if you compare Ohio State to some of its peers, you will, I assert, see huge variance. Huge variance. And why is it there? What explains why what we're discussing today gets implemented quickly some places and slowly others, or not at all at some schools? And I just would say quickly in reaction to that, the easiest curriculum change occurs when there's a crisis, complaints from students and faculty, there's a vacuum because of gaps in faculty, all the legal process or all the civil procedure professors have left and retired at the same time. Wham, you know, expand constitutional law, you know, right? Where there's a lack of opposition from tenured faculty, where there's few cost trade-offs visible to faculty, and there's no increase in the work for tenured faculty, right? That describes easy curriculum reform. Hard curriculum change, when you have something that already seems to work from some point of view, meaning nobody's complaining or throwing rocks at the dean about it. When you have something that requires little current work from a relevant constituency, the faculty, tenured faculty, and where you want to change into something that costs more in terms of time and money and resources and faculty time. And I guess my general point then is much of what Judith's research has shown and Mary Beth described takes a lot of work. It's the hardest form of curriculum reform, I think, and that explains where there's been a lot of change has required some courage, okay? Not just kind of, it doesn't happen naturally for good reasons. The last general observation is just, I think the most important. There is terrific variance across schools in the norms as to what the acceptable quality of teaching is, and that applies in writing and research as well. I mean, law schools aren't ranked by teaching quality except through the 2% bar pass, that 2% of the ranking that's bar passage, right? And let's suggest possibly that bar exam pass rates are not the only measure of effective teaching, okay? There is a cynical tendency of most of us to believe that, in fact, there isn't that much difference or variance in teaching among instructors in a particular course, or across law schools. There's a few stars and a few duds, but mostly you've seen one Socratic civil procedure course. You've pretty much seen 90% of what you'd see elsewhere. And that's just wrong. Okay, I just have to say, and I base that on empirical observation, there is great variance, not just between instructors in one school, but more importantly across school. The norms for what is expected in terms of quality of teaching, best practices and methods, goals, theory, are really quite different at different schools. And this is driven home to me this year. I've seen civil procedure taught at six different law schools in the last 18 months. And And then I went to one law school and I attended a civil procedure class, and it blew me away because it was an order of magnitude out of the distribution in terms of the quality of thought going into how it was done and how thoughtful. And I came out of that class saying, wow, this person has to be the star of the faculty, right? The one teacher, right? And the response of everybody I talked to is, no, there's five or six people pretty much like that, that kind of, and there's a lot of young people, you know, right on their heels. And what that told me is the norm was so much higher there in terms of thought about what they were trying to do and how they were trying to do that, and that maybe deans can help with norms. And it's possible for norms to be dramatically different, even among peers. Okay, quick responses to, first to Judith Wagner and then to Mary Beth Beasley, and then let's open it up. First of all, as you saw Bloom's educational objectives quickly on the screen, and versions of them that have been incorporated in various ways, you know, knowledge, analysis, synthesis, application, all the things on the board there. I think many professors' reaction to that is, oh, that's interesting. I do all those things. I just never articulated it that way before, right? I do all those things, right? So what does that add? Oh, it's another education school thing, right, with a little pyramid and diagrams. And my reaction to that from teaching a long time now is pretty much that's like saying, I save money. I just don't do a budget or balance my checkbook or even write down the checks, right? Right? So because I just do that. I just know it happens, right? And from our experience with checkbooks, we know if you don't do it, you may think you're doing it, but it probably doesn't really happen. I say that with caution because Vanderbilt is one of those schools studied, and I hope it had a benign rather than a malignant biopsy as a result of that. So that provokes some reaction. First of all, integration of what we saw in both those presentation and first-year courses, other first-year courses other than legal research and writing. My experience is that's most places is most, not some I visited, but at most places it's somewhat one-sided in the sense of legal research and writing faculty take the other first-year courses as they find them and work around them, right? That it takes status before it's a two-way interchange to figure out whether we're really achieving all the purposes together. My experience with the cognitive apprenticeship, which is another way of describing making the thinking visible, is that's what people say they do. Oh, that's what I do. I'm trying to make people think, right? I want to make them know they're thinking and know how they're thinking, right? That's the toughest and most important thing most of us do. If you get to an exam and grade an exam in almost any course, your frustration is how much is left implicit, how much they don't say and examine and challenge, right? They say A is true, B is true, therefore C is true. They don't say why A and B lead to C. They don't say what their reasoning or analogy is that leads from A and B to C. They just assert it. Why? Because it sounds more authoritative that way. If I express uncertainty, then I don't know what I'm talking about, right? And I guess the making thinking explicit is something better done through writing than orally, because it's just driven home more orally. I mean, after I saw Mary Beth's presentation with the colors the first time, I started giving out exam answers with boldface, underlined, italics, right? Here is where somebody deals with a counterargument, identifies it, and here is where they respond to it, right? Here is where somebody explains why from A and B, C is true. Not just asserts it, but explains why. And that's essentially something I've learned from writing teachers. And the last thing is the best practices. The best practices that involve huge costs don't get implemented. So the question, as I go down these lists of things, is what are best practices that involve manageable costs? Those tend to get implemented and tend to stick. And then the last thing I'd say in response to Judith is that the Law School Admissions Council is developing a diagnostic assessment tool aimed at college freshmen and sophomores. It's called the Skills Readiness Inventory. It's somewhat controversial because they are not trying to develop a PSAT. They're not trying to make a lot of money, right? They're not trying to discourage people from applying to law school because they get a low score on their PSAT or whatever. But that's a couple of years away, but there's a lot of money and effort going into it, and it's the primary effort of Alex Dennison, who's now at the University of Minnesota. And then in reacting specifically to Mary Beth Beasley. Can you teach people how to write? The drunken question, right? Yes. I know this is true. I know this is true because when I was born, I couldn't write. So I assert somebody taught me how to do it. And most of us have a somebody, and it's the somebody who did the things Mary Beth described. Not the somebody who gave me a lecture about it, but the somebody who sat down. Not the somebody who edited my piece and made it beautiful, right? But the somebody who asked me a million questions and made me state explicitly what I was trying to do and why, and converted me to that. I don't think that what I draw from that is, yes, you can teach somebody how to write. It takes a lot of work. Everything you described is a lot. Feed forward tutorial. Boy, you know, why not grade an exam three times instead of once, you know, if we stay rough to private memos. It is not intuitively obvious to most students that it's a good thing to drop footnotes describing their uncertainties about what they're doing. You know, please take off your armor so that Professor Killer can stick knives in it. Right? But that's what you need. I don't think the good news that legal writing and research faculty have done a lot of what best practices suggest has disseminated widely. I think it is status dependent. I do think lots of the barriers you've described to distribution through the other groups of faculty, of whom there are many different groups, not just tenured, but clinical and so on. The happy thing about those barriers, which is the last thing you did, is that almost all of them, I believe, are surmountable, right? That I don't think the time pressures, the Jane Austen status questions, the inertia of I'm teaching my course the same way I did for the last 16 years, I don't think the fear of telling too much or the status issues aren't surmountable. There has to be a will to surmount them. And that's, from my point of view, largely the responsibility of the director and the dean, right, to develop the kind of constituency for that will to surmount them. Which leads me just to open it up now for a question on our general issues and you to take shots at us. I want to point out, by the way, there's also a teaching method section presentation on student incivilities, which may be particularly relevant to this group. The questions, again, are dilemmas you've encountered in using writing to enhance students' thinking and best practices to enrich students' thinking abilities. Shall we all get up?
Please turn your cable for now for the continuation of this presentation. Thank you.
To speak in this mic because we're being recorded, that would be very helpful.
I'm Greg Sergienko, and I wanted to comment on one thing that I think is important in understanding the relationship between thinking and writing, but which Bloom's taxonomy leaves out, and Kent has touched on it. That's that a lot of what goes into good writing is also what would be called an attitudinal goal. Do students want to do a certain thing? One of the things Kent mentioned that students don't want to do is they don't want to take off their armor. Indirectly, I think a lot of what we have to do is address attitudinal goals and making ourselves conscious of what attitudes we want students to have towards learning and writing can be really important. Even though as we look back on a product-based approach, they may not be that significant. We assess maybe on the paper or on the exam. But inculcating attitudes can be important in real life as a lawyer, but also in improving the learning process for students.
Neat. Yeah, I think that taking off the armor is hard to get them into. The big change we had at Ohio State was an attitudinal change. When our faculty started teaching legal writing, that the students' attitude suddenly changed to, oh, I guess this really is important. And it was a huge difference in attitude, and that made it much easier to teach them. And so to the extent that you are affecting attitude, you really can be affecting how well you can teach. So that's a very good observation.
I think, too, part of the armor business is they put on armor in the large classes. So it's as if they're not only armor-plated, boiler-plated, whatever else. So having learned so much that they need it, it's probably harder yet to take it off.
We have so many resources in the audience. I really hope that you all will come forward and share your ideas. Please do.
While I was thinking about what Dean Severed said about things that are expensive being the last ones to be able to get through. And it occurred to me that one of the things I've noticed with students in large classes sometimes is that they'll come back and say, why doesn't the professor ever let me know what I should be writing down? Why doesn't the professor ever comment on whose responses are better than other people's? How do I know which student's response I should be listening to? And obviously that somewhat reflects that they're looking for clarity in a way which is not what we're trying to teach. But I also think it's an easy thing to deal with, because if the professors in those classes articulate for the students what it is they hope them to do in that class and why it is that they are not summing up and putting outlines on the board or giving them a series of 6 points, I think that begins to help them understand, you know, what this taxonomy thing is all about, but maybe in a less jargony way. So that's just a thought that I have. That's a no-cost thought that would, I think, ease a lot of anxiety for some students in some large classes. I'm sure there are teachers who do that now.
I will talk about another no-cost thing related to that, and that is just one of the things that I think our legal writing faculty have been doing over the years is labeling intellectual steps within the writing process and labeling components and labeling things. And that is a no-cost thing that large class faculty can do. If they are doing all this wonderful, as Judith said, the increase in knowledge and in thinking process over the course of that first year is incredible. And yet I think a lot of the students couldn't take apart and label what they're doing. Here is when I'm identifying the counter arguments. Here is when I'm articulating the rules or whatever. They really haven't thought of the labels for the steps that they're taking. And maybe by encouraging the labeling of the thinking steps that are going on in the classroom, it could make it easier for the students to understand, oh, I haven't done all of the steps. Again, that goes to the scaffolding kind of thing you were talking about.
Just briefly, too, I think we're in an era where what I call stand-up faculty may be seeing more visibly where their students are thinking, because many people are using these course software like Blackboard.com and TWEN. And if you have either discussion boards or they have a very effective assessment tool, I've been putting old exam questions in and then posting my issues lists and giving that in my class of 80 as participation points if they do it. I wonder if any of you might consider going to maybe a particularly sympathetic stand-up faculty member and asking to be signed on as an observer or something to some of those courses, because I think you could really open an interesting dialogue by giving them an observation or two with some of the language of what you're seeing there. And I think it really also gives you insight into the students you're teaching to see them in that milieu. So I really think that's going to be a very important dimension and a place where things are visible that we might be able to benefit from.
I was pleased to hear that the Carnegie comparisons are being drawn to engineering, medicine, and the like, because I see the glamour and the expense of jobs and intellectual property are drawing people to us who previously would not have gone to law school. And for them, our significant dilemma is they weren't taught to think in a writing narrative sense as we are, in a persuasive sense. And that's a bigger deficit for those students coming into our law classes than the conventional history or political science person. And I wonder if you've encountered that and how you've dealt with it.
Certainly, you can tell the people who have had writing experience and the people who haven't had writing experience. I think I really encourage any kind of dilemma I face with a student, I encourage more private memos, because I tell them the more I know what you're struggling with, the more we can talk to each other effectively, and I hope I can help you. And so I think articulating criteria, I didn't get a chance to put up the criteria sheets, but really trying to articulate steps that they need to go through. You know, as we say, writing is a series of decisions, and when you give them a routine, as Judith was saying, you give them a routine. You got to start by considering, you know, if we're talking about research process, what are the questions you have to go through for research process? Okay, for writing, what are the steps you have to go through for writing process? A lot of the legal writing textbooks now, Shapo, Walter and Fagins was one of the first, where they are labeling on the margin, here's what's going on here, here, and here. So letting them see those examples with very concrete labeling on it, I think, can help. I'm a fan of labeling.
Well, I have the pleasure of working with Kent at Vanderbilt, and so I'll just mention one thing that he has done that has really helped, which is to tell students how important the course is, how important it is to learn the legal writing. And that gets to a dilemma that maybe doesn't apply to all of our students, but it is a portion of them, and it's a portion of them that I worry a lot about, and that's the students who don't get it, who don't understand why this might really be important for what they are going to do in practice, and consequently don't put in the energy, don't really invest what they need to invest to get what they need. And a lot of different factors influence that: credits for the course, status, and just in general, how does the dean, how does the faculty talk about the course to the students? So what are the students hearing and learning about that from people that they, whose opinions they will respect?
We have time for one last question.
Hello. I'm Mary Campbell Gallagher, and I hope we don't make too much fun of the 2% that represents passing the bar, because that's what puts bread and butter on my table. I have a business that teaches people legal writing for the bar exam. I don't necessarily see your most gifted students. But what I can say about what I see, as though law school were a black box, even though obviously I went through the box myself, is that the biggest poison in law school is issue spotting talk. That students produce something that's like a Rorschach test, and they think that what they're doing is issue spotting, and apparently somebody gave them a passing grade once upon a time for doing that. So they don't see it as principle, application, conclusion. They see it as get in there and like a bug in the carpet and snap up all those issues. So that is from the battleground at the other end of the process. And I've loved this. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you all for coming to the first of, that's right, three legal writing presentations. We hope to see you at the receptions and at the other presentations. If you'll join me now in thanking this wonderful panel.
That concludes this presentation. Thank you.